reconvene. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning, Council. Before we begin, I would like to introduce some guests we have this morning to hear this case. We have students from Lodi High School. Would they stand, please? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. We have students from New Hope Christian. Would they stand, please? And thank you all for coming. The students are here with a program that is sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. And this program invites all high school students across the state to come and listen to an oral argument. And if the invitation is accepted, the students get briefs, and they may do a variety of activities related to the case to learn more about it. This is a national award-winning program of which we are very proud, and I think we're in our 10th year in this program. So we have met you. I'd like to introduce the court to the bench. I'm going to start on my far left with Justice Pat Robensack. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. David Prosser will meet with all the students who can come at the... You are. I'm sorry. That was changed. Good. Okay. Justice Robensack will meet with all the students at 10:45. Gonna come here at 10:45, and then that came at the earlier one. She'll meet them right after the last oral argument this morning, and she will discuss the procedures of the court, not the substance of the case. Anyone who wishes to join the students in that discussion is welcome. Seated next to Justice Robensack is Justice Dave Prosser, who is on for tomorrow with Court with Class. And as to my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I am Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. Seated next to him is Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far right is Justice Diane Sykes. With those introductions made, I will call the second case, Brown versus Lurk and Schultz, Saver, Racine, et al. Arguing for Schultz et al. Is Michael C. Froman. Mr. Froman.
May it please the court. My name is Mike Froman. I'm the counsel for defendants, respondents, petitioners. The Schultz Sable grocery store chain, otherwise known as Piggly Wiggly, and also the Reliance Insurance Company. This is a workers' compensation case involving a claim for penalty for bad faith claims handling. Benefits were originally conceded to the employee, Kelly Brown, and payments of temporary total disability were made to him. He had his original injury in 1993. He had surgery in 1995. Payments were subsequently suspended, cut off, in January of 1996, and the issue here is whether the insurance company acted reasonably in suspending those benefits before the time that the healing period came to an end. The department and the commission, the Labor and Industry Review Commission, referred to sometimes as LIRC, ruled that the carrier did have a reasonable basis to believe that Brown was engaged in wage-earning activities, and that his right to receive payments of TTD benefits was fairly debatable. The agency's ruling was affirmed by the circuit court, but then reversed by the Court of Appeals, who found the claims investigation to be inadequate and assessed a bad faith penalty. I believe the issue raised on petition is did the carrier conduct an adequate investigation? And more specifically, must the carrier have in its possession the kind of detailed wage information or self-employment earnings information necessary to calculate a week-by-week offset before it can suspend benefits? Secondarily, we have the issue of whether the court should have deferred to the agency's value judgments in the area of potential fraud and workers' compensation penalties.
What was Mr. Brown's obligation here, counsel?
His allegation?
His obligation. Since he had this job, he was an independent insurance agent. Did he have was his obligation to report to the company, or since it was a relatively new business and he hadn't earned it, apparently everyone agrees he had not earned any, he was not in a profitable status here. What was his obligation?
As a claimant for temporary and total disability benefits, claimants ordinarily do not earn money while they're healing from their injuries. And if they do go out and earn money, that's something the claims representative should know about. And I think I don't believe that injured workers receive a set of instructions that they necessarily realize this. Sometimes both the individual worker and the carrier stumble upon the situation and they say, wait a minute, we need to make a correction here.
Sure, but isn't it laudable? It's, you know, he's trying to earn some money to support himself and others. What was his obligation to the company?
Well, his obligation, I think, is to contact the insurance carrier and to say, look, I'm out here working, I'm making money. As far as the carrier knew, the carrier knew that he was out working from various sources. I think to answer your question precisely, it's that injured workers who are able to work and earn money need to let the insurance carrier who is paying full total disability benefits know about that.
Mr. Frohman, what's wrong with a rule that basically says, look, before you cut off somebody's benefits, you contact them. You get their side of the situation. Isn't that what the Court of Appeals, in essence, was saying in this case?
I agree. I think the Court of Appeals admonished the claims representative of the carrier by saying you could have called. And I think the answer to that is, given what the claims manager knew, he didn't believe it was worthwhile to make that call. Claims managers and anyone who has spent any time handling workers' compensation cases, you know, gets a healthy bit of skepticism over the years, and they see people who are paid money who don't necessarily deserve to get the money. And he did not feel that it was worthwhile to call a suspected fraudulent person and ask, by the way, are you making money? He didn't think the information that he would get would be at all reliable. And I think that's why he resisted the claimant's subsequent letters from counsel saying, my client isn't making money. It's your obligation to prove he is. I think that just convinced the claims manager that something was being hidden here. Income was being hidden.
Am I correct that under the administrative rules, the administrative scheme that's involved here, that it's not just a matter of making money, but it's a matter of actually, after deducting expenses, having a net income?
This is one of the problems that I think the Court of Appeals focused on, or I think one of the problems with the Court of Appeals decision is that in the practical administration of workers' compensation claims handling, it is true that earnings by commission sales can be made in a given week and not paid until much later. The rule is in workers' compensation, though, that those payments are to be attributed to the week in which they are earned. In other words, when the activity takes place that generates the income. And I think by, you know, the court's ruling in this matter demonstrated, I think, a lack of deference to the commission's understanding that this is not a simple process. To get this information from someone who is self-employed requires a great deal of effort and time. In fact, in this particular case, when it wound up in the hearing for the indemnity benefits, the carrier subpoenaed those records and was frustrated even at that time. But it is a problem with, in terms of the practical considerations, because this is a system without any formal discovery. There's no way for that claims manager to compel the production of documentation from a suspected cheater, saying, if I call you up, I will say, please tell me what you're making. And the worker says, well, I'm not making anything. It doesn't do the claims manager any good to make that call. So I think what was going on was the claims manager was relying on observation and reports from more disinterested parties, not from the person who has a financial motivation in providing a specific response. But I think the way that the commission framed the issue is appropriate here, and it can be contrasted meaningfully with the way the Court of Appeals framed the issue. The commission said that the issue was whether the carrier had a reasonable basis to believe that Brown was engaged in wage-earning services. And certainly at the time benefits were discontinued, the carrier did have that information from three different sources. Now, the Court of Appeals framed the issue as whether the carrier had enough information about the actual gross sales, the expenses for business, the net income, so that it could calculate a precise offset before it could suspend benefits. And it pointed to, in the Court of Appeals, it pointed to the claims manager's admission at the penalty hearing that he didn't know that much. He didn't have that much information. But the claims manager freely admitted that because he didn't believe he needed that information. He thought he needed to show that a worker who was paying total disability benefits was out there working and wasn't reporting any income and therefore suspended benefits. I think the petitioners in this case assert to the court that the information required to make the claim fairly debatable at that point is less information than what is required to remove all doubt about the issue entirely, and that is information that the court pointed to. If the claims manager had the offset information, there would be no doubt at all about what to do in the case. The standard isn't no doubt. The standard is fairly debatable, and I think that's what the claims manager was relying upon.
Counsel, at this pause in your argument, I'm going to ask if you could maybe move the podium up. I'm having a little difficulty hearing you, or perhaps...
the microphone?
No, there's a button on your left side, left top of the podium.
To push it up?
Push it.
One way.
That's it.
I see.
Magic. Thank you.
Sorry. I think we can, if I can return to some of the facts of the case. Was the carrier's investigation adequate or inadequate? What we have is a carrier who is paying benefits on a conceded basis until he receives a phone call from the department's fraud investigation unit. There's a tip that Mr. Brown is working full-time, getting workers' compensation benefits, bragging about his circumstances in working the system in this way. This occurred in October of 1995, and I think it's important to note that 3 months go by before the carrier suspends benefits. And during that three-month period of time, it goes on to investigate further, calls the grocery store manager, says, what do you know about this guy? The grocery store manager comes back and says, well, the word in the meat department is that Mr. Brown is selling insurance. He's working somewhere else. He doesn't plan to come back. Thom then hires an investigation agency and hires a surveillance man to go out and follow Brown around. And so they find him in December of 1995 in the insurance salesman's uniform, the business suit with the briefcase, and driving around town on a Wednesday morning. They also find that he's been licensed as an insurance salesperson in Wisconsin since 1994. So this information tells the claims manager that we've got someone who has some experience. He's out there making a living. He is clearly intending to make this his career. The notification came then on February 1st of 1996 to the claimant saying that, you know, based on the lack of income information from you, we are suspending your benefits.
Why is it significant that Mr. Brown was driving around town with a business suit?
Mr. Brown's normal occupation was a grocery store meat department worker, and what the carrier was asking the investigator to find out was, is he working as an insurance salesman? And I think just finding him attired in that way, you know, led to the conclusion that, yes, our original tips were correct. He is working as an insurance salesman.
Was there any observation of him actually meeting with people to sell insurance or any?
No, the investigator wasn't, you know, they have limited ability to tail people, and they can't get involved in the personal sales meetings. You know, they can see him go from place to place in his car carrying a briefcase, and that was what the investigation showed. The investigator testified that he didn't know precisely what Mr. Brown was up to that day, or whether he was selling insurance or what he was doing. In fact, the videotaped surveillance actually showed him carrying a box into a daycare center, and it proved that in later testimony that was a box of toys. And he wasn't at that time doing anything about selling insurance.
Could you explain exactly what the Court of Appeals did here in terms of reviewing the judgment of the administrative law judge and Lurk? What did they do?
I think there's two problems with the Court of Appeals' decision. The first one I mentioned, they changed the standard for bad faith from what is fairly debatable, what the parties can argue about, to requiring absolute evidence. Second thing I think the Court of Appeals did wrong in this case was it suggested that the commission may not take into consideration events following the initial denial of benefits. I think it's clear that they can. They are, and they ought to, take into account the behavior of the parties following the initial denial or suspension of benefits. And I think that the case law very well demonstrates that this happens and that this should happen. The last year's Court of Appeals case, Beverly Enterprises, involved an employer who didn't think it had to pay the full gross amount of a department order, a commission order. It thought it could just pay the net amount after subtracting income taxes. Following that position, counsel for the claimant sent the employer a commission precedent right on point saying, no, that doesn't happen. And the employer continued its denial of the claim despite that evidence or that proof. And the court found in Beverly Enterprises that the commission certainly should consider the fact that the denial of payment continued following evidence given to the employer after the fact of the denial that showed that it was wrong. The same thing in the Kimberly-Clark case, the Court of Appeals 1987 case. It was a hearing loss case. The employer, after the denial, obtained noise level tests, which they claim show that it wasn't noisy enough in that plant to cause hearing loss. It also sent the man to an independent medical expert whose opinion was that it was a payable claim. The employer ignored these subsequent proofs and continued their denial. That was found to be in bad faith, and the commission was properly permitted to consider those things. When we look at Mr. Brown's case, the Court of Appeals decision said you may not look any further than from the moment you suspended benefits because that's when the bad faith occurred. And I think that's wrong because what happened following that discontinuation of benefits is very important here. The parties got into this dispute over who had to prove what. The claims manager says, I know you're working. You've got to tell me what you're making or give me some documentation that I can see for myself what you're making. The claimant said, we don't have to give you anything, and you're going to be guilty of bad faith if you don't pick up benefits right away. And it just entrenched their positions. But everything that the claims manager came across following that reinforced its belief that earnings were being hidden, that temporary total disability benefits were not due. That includes Brown's initial response from his attorney following the cutoff of benefits. The letter of February 6, 1996, confirmed that Brown was engaged in a business. Secondly, there was an independent medical evaluation set up by the carrier showing in April of 1996 that Brown told the doctor he was involved with this organization called World Marketing Alliance. Then the World Marketing Alliance was contacted. They said, we can't tell you anything about his earnings activities because he's not really an employee, he's an independent contractor. Then there was the income tax records for the prior year, 1995. Those were obtained, showing gross earnings from insurance sales of over $2,200. And this in a year when he was working full-time in the meat department at the Piggly Wiggly store, and when he had surgery in August and spent the next couple months probably recovering from that. So in the mind of the claims manager, this still shows that now that he's working full-time, in 1996, in insurance sales, he must be making quite a bit if he was able to make over $2,200 the previous year in just a part-time situation. So what my point on this issue is that the commission can and should consider the behavior of the parties following the initial suspension or denial to see how they behaved, how they reacted to the proofs of the case as they came in. And I think it was that consideration that led the commission, the agency who is in charge of regulating this area, in deciding that when we weigh the equities here, you know, the carrier may have done some things better. It concedes that, but all in all, it wasn't bad faith. They had enough to make that suspension, and then everything that they found out after that, leading up to the benefit hearing, confirmed their belief that money was being made and hidden from the carrier.
Counsel, I hear your answer to Justice Prosser's question a bit different than the way I read your brief. As I understand, the question was, what's wrong with the Court of Appeals opinion?
Yes.
And you said, I have two problems, and then the first one was that they changed the standard from fairly debatable to requiring absolute proof. That was your response. And then the second problem you had dealt with use of the information acquired after the initial determination to discontinue. I read your brief, however, you had two main arguments, A and B, and B, as I read it, at least dealt with, in part, the two-prong test of Kimberly, and you say that in your first sentence of that argument subsection, the Court of Appeals concluded that the insurer lacked a reasonable basis for suspending Brown's benefits, but did not proceed to find that the insurer acted with knowledge or reckless disregard of the lack of such a reasonable basis as required by the two-part test. Are you abandoning that argument now, which was one of your two main arguments in your brief, or are you continuing with that position?
Justice Bradley, I am not abandoning that. I think there's a lot of subsets of problems here. I have to admit that in preparation for today's arguments, in rereading the cases, You know, it occurred to me that one of the things that the commission does on a regular basis is to look at all of the behavior of the parties, knowing their rights and responsibilities, and that this is part of my argument that the court should have let the commission handle this one. It's part of my due deference argument, actually. My complaint about this Court of Appeals, as stated in the brief, that they did not adequately address the knowledge portion of the two-part bad faith test, I think still stands. And on rereading the court's opinion over and over, you know, I see only one area where they mention knowledge on the part of the claims manager, and that is the part where he admits on examination at the penalty hearing that, yes, I did not have the information necessary to calculate a week-by-week offset. I realized that. I didn't have that, but I still suspended benefits. I think that is the court's only reference to knowledge or bad intent. And I think it's an inappropriate reference because the claims manager did not know that he was denying the claim with no reasonable basis. He simply admitted that he couldn't calculate the exact offset at the time. He didn't have that much information. The court's saying, look, you admit you don't have the requisite information to assess whether you owe TTD benefits or temporary partial benefits. Therefore, when you cut off payment, you are in bad faith. And the knowledge element of the two-part test requires that the carrier know that it is not following the rules, that it is faced with evidence that shows the claim to have no reasonable doubt about paying, no fairly debatable issue. And so I appreciate your question, and I wish to emphasize again that the knowledge element was not adequately addressed in the Court of Appeals decision.
Well, the Court of Appeals, Kimberly basically came out of the Anderson case, which is in 78, and we're talking about the couple of prongs dealing with bad faith in it. It seemed to me that the Court of Appeals never discussed that second prong that you're referring to. In other words, the insured must show that the insurer proceeded with the knowledge or reckless disregard that it lacked a reasonable basis. In other words, that's what your argument is. But that wasn't discussed by the Court of Appeals, was it?
The Court of Appeals, in all these cases, sets forth the two-part test admirably. I think it's such a basic concept coming down from Anderson. In every single case you read on this issue, the two-part test is set forth. And in one of the cases, North American Mechanical, the commission issued its decision finding bad faith without adequately addressing the knowledge element, and the Court of Appeals decision in that case sent it back, saying, you know, Anderson says that bad faith cannot be unintentional. You have to consider this. So I think in every case that I've read on this issue, the courts will set the two-part test out there, but whether they actually follow it, in this case, I think it didn't follow it.
Well, why did the Court of Appeals have to follow the second stage of the Anderson? Because the Court of Appeals concluded that in interpreting fairly debatable, it wasn't fairly debatable here. If you don't pass the first prong of Anderson, you never have to get to the second prong. And they just dealt with the first prong.
And my response is that it's not sufficient to just deal with the first prong.
Why?
Because then the test is no different from inexcusable delay in issuing benefits, which is a penalty included in the Workers' Compensation Act, where intent does not come up. The North American Mechanical Court of Appeals case had a very nice analysis of the various penalties, saying that there's some There's some excusable delay, there's some inexcusable delay, and then there's bad faith. And bad faith requires intent. And you cannot have bad faith without bad intent. And that is one of the essential requirements of a finding of insurance claims handling bad faith, that you meet not only the fact that the first test of no reasonable basis, no fairly debatable issue, and then you proceed to, did the carrier know this? I mean, and that's precisely why the post-denial activity is important in this case, because in the other cases, the post-activity information was square in the face of the employer saying, you have no leg to stand on, and they continued their and that's where the bad intent comes up. I'm out of time, Your Honor. So.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Counsel arguing for Kelly Brown is John A. Becker. Mr. Becker.
Good morning, Your Honors. Also seated at the counsel table with me is my partner, Scott French. And I don't know whether I should just get into my arguments or respond to some of the things that Mr. Frohman has said, but before I get started, there are a few things I'd like you to keep in mind. And I think a lot of times insurance companies lose this perspective. I think defense attorneys lose this perspective because they deal with insurance companies and they're not dealing with individuals. And to be honest with you, I think sometimes applicants' attorneys lose the perspective that these people need this money to live on. They need this money to pay their rent, to pay their put food on the table, pay their health insurance, whatever it may be. And like I say, even applicants' attorneys, we get calls and somebody says, my check's a week late. And we say, well, can't you wait? You know, it's only a couple $100. These people need this money, and this is a big deal to them. What we have here, and the other thing that Mr. Frohman has mentioned in his brief and he mentioned today about fraud. This is not a fraud case. He's trying to turn the focus onto something that is not. Quite clearly it is not. He talked about Mr. Brown not bringing records according to a subpoena, and that's been mentioned. And I want to point out that Mr. Brown provided whatever records Mr. Frohman requested. I want to first of all review some facts because there's a lot of things in this case that are not in dispute. I mean, what's not in dispute is the fact that Mr. Brown sustained a work-related injury. What's not in dispute is the fact that Mr. Brown was in the healing period until August of 1996. There's also other facts that we don't dispute. We don't dispute that Mr. Thome got a phone call from the Workers' Comp Division, an anonymous phone call saying that he may be working. He also contacted Mr. Robert David from Piggly Wiggly to see what was going on, and Mr. David said, yes, he heard that Mr. Brown was selling insurance. Well, first of all, to even consider that was error, and it's an evidentiary ruling. It's like third-hand hearsay. Mr. David wasn't there to testify. The butcher he talked to wasn't there to testify, who said, you know, that he heard that Kelly wasn't coming back. We don't know what that statement was. Did Mr. David say, well, geez, Kelly's had back surgery. He's a butcher. He might not be able to return to work here, so he's looking into something that he might be able to do, a light-duty job that he can handle, and he's looking into the insurance business. So what? So, again, at that point, what knowledge does Thome have? He has some knowledge that he might be selling insurance.
Whose obligation is it, I ask opposing counsel, to, after your client has received his disability and he's trying to supplement his income or get a new occupation, whose obligation is it to find out or to let them know that, hey, I'm doing this?
I don't know that the obligation specifically falls on either party. As Mr. Brown testified at the hearing,
nobody has a responsibility?
Mr. Brown is not an attorney. He testified at the hearing that even if he got a job, he didn't know he was supposed to report that. And I think that's the case with most people. If they are working a job and now they're off and they say, geez, I could go out and get a part-time job and make a little money, most people don't even realize they're supposed to report that. But the insurance adjuster does know that. If he has some suspicions that he's working, all he has to do is call. Kelly Brown has never denied it from day one. The very first notice that Kelly Brown got that there was an accusation he was making money was in February. And the very first response from my office was, yes, he is working. So what? We know that. We're not denying that. So regardless of whose obligation it is, certainly the adjuster has more information and more knowledge about this. If he suspects it, he could contact Kelly Brown to find out.
Counselor, is there any difference in this case that we should ascribe to the fact that he was receiving total temporary disability rather than partial temporary disability in regard to your so what he's working claim?
I don't understand the question. No, I don't see any
you're
difference.
You're totally disabled and you receive those benefits because you can't work. Now, if he's only partially disabled, then perhaps he could do some things but not others. Here he's receiving disability benefits, not for partial disability, but because he's totally temporarily disabled. And when the employer receives information that he's working, isn't that inconsistent with the payment for total disability?
No, no.
Okay, and why not?
Okay, because the law is and the rule is in workers' comp that if you are injured on the job and you are unable to go back, the doctor has you on restrictions, you're unable to go back to work, you're entitled to get paid by your employer while you're off. If the doctor gives you 25-pound restrictions and you're a butcher and you have to lift 50 pounds, you're entitled to stay off of work while you're in the healing process and get paid. If they have light-duty work for you, you can go back. Yes, it's not, I mean, it's partial disability in that sense. If they have light-duty work, you can go back. You get paid partial benefits based upon how much you're making, whether you're making 75% of your wage or whatever it is. So it doesn't really matter. I mean, his doctor had him, both doctors authorized him to be off of work, and he was off of work. He was not working. So he was entitled to temporary total disability.
Okay. Thank you.
Counsel, do you agree with the standard of review set forth in the Court of Appeals opinion, page 7 of the slip opinion? It says, it must be paragraph 10, Lurk has developed extensive experience and expertise in applying the law of bad faith and the criteria for determining when a claim is fairly debatable, as articulated by the statutes and case law, and its decisions on such matters should be given great weight on review. We will thus defer to Lurk's legal conclusions if they are found to be reasonable, even if we would not have reached the same conclusion. Do you agree that's the correct standard?
Not necessarily. I think both parties set forth a standard of review. I think there are no questions about the facts. Again, we'll go through the facts here. Nobody's disputing any of the facts. The application of facts to a statute is a question of law. However, to be honest with you, I don't know that it matters. The Court of Appeals applied a deferential standard of review and still said there was no evidence to support what they did, and I agree with that 100%.
I just want to find out, maybe you answered it, that is, you don't care, and I don't mean
that. I didn't mean it quite like that.
No, I don't mean that negatively. I mean that you don't think it's almost relevant for the analysis.
Correct.
But let me ask it more pointedly. Is Lurk entitled to great weight deference in this case?
I don't think so. Is it
entitled to due weight deference?
They may reach that point. If I can refer, the Kimberly Clark case was 1987. The court there said, because we conclude that LARC has neither expertise nor a body of precedent on this question, this court need not defer to LARC's conclusion regarding whether a person's claim was fairly debatable. Now, there has been some cases since that. That was 15 years ago, so should they give them some due deference? I don't have a problem with that.
Assume, counsel, that Lurk has a website, and assume that on their website they have listed 711 full-text Lurk decisions online, and assume 43 of those match the query bad faith. If that's correct, is that sufficient, in your opinion, to conclude that Lurk has enough experience to be given great weight deference?
No. 43 cases is not a lot. I mean, there's a lot of different circumstances in which those cases could arise. You have different administrative law judges addressing those cases. Giving them due deference, that's fine. I mean, great weight and deference, no. I mean, these are facts. There is not a dispute about any one fact in this case that I can see. And applying those facts to a legal standard is generally a question of law. Will the court give some deference to the commission even on a question of law like that? Sure. But great weight and deference? No, I don't think so. So again, going back to what we know, anonymous phone call. He talks with Mr. David. So what does he do? He hires a private investigator. That shows him in a business suit, one out of four times they follow him. And again, without reading the testimony, the administrative law judge at the first hearing says, well, how much time did he spend when he went into that place the one time you showed him in a suit? 5 minutes. Do you think he could have sold insurance in 5 minutes? The investigator said no.
Now, as I understand, when you say the facts you're presenting him, I just want to know that this is correct. I thought that there wasn't an anonymous. The phone call to the company came from the workers' compensation fraud investigator. They notified. It wasn't anonymous to the company. This came from the fraud division. Are you saying that?
No. The fraud division got an anonymous phone call.
I understand, but you've said anonymous phone call, but basically the way the company found out about this, it came from the state.
Right. Right. The state advised them that they got an anonymous phone call. So Mr. Thorne then goes out and hires an investigator. And what does it show? According to his testimony, not much. So in December, he has no more information than he has in October, other than he might be selling insurance. He knows that he's licensed to sell insurance since 1994. And again, in workers' comp, he was treating this as a 1995 injury. Mr. Brown was injured in 1993. He continued to work for 2 years. Had a re-aggravation in 1995. Thorne was treating this as a 1995 injury. If you have a job, if you're working one job and you have another part-time job and you get hurt on the first job, you can continue to work that second job and there's no offset. If you get hurt and you go out and get a second job, then there's an offset. Thorne was treating this as a 1995 injury, finds out he's been licensed since 1994 and still claims an offset. So in December, he doesn't really know anything more than he knew before, except he does not have a business phone number. And in February, he cuts him off. And on what basis? We don't know. He writes him a letter and says, you're exceeding your restrictions, which was a lie. And he admitted that was a lie, and that was not a basis for cutting him off. And then says he's earning income. Mr. Brown worked almost 20 years as a butcher. And Mr. Thome, he has surgery in August of 1995. And now Mr. Thome, in February of 1996, takes a 100% offset, which would mean that Brown would have to be making $35,000 a year as an insurance agent to take 100% offset. In February, he doesn't know any more than he does in December, which he didn't know any more than he did in October. Yet in February, he decides he's going to cut him off. And then when he does, he contacts Brown, and what's Brown's response? Yes, he is working. He made $600-some or whatever it was last year. What's your basis here for cutting him off and making these allegations? Again, Thome doesn't respond. So what happens next? We file an application, then he's forced to respond. And again, it goes back and forth. They order an IME, which confirms what Brown's doctor says. Now, I tell you, the frustration in this case for us, I think, was coming through also at the first hearing. Judge Mitchell was getting frustrated with the defendants. When he asked, after a line of questioning, he says, it's my understanding that question should have been asked before. Why do we have to have someone come up here under oath and ask like this, meaning the questions that Brown was being asked? So my question to you, counsel, is why are we here and why weren't these questions asked prior to today? And you better put something in the record that they were asked prior today, or otherwise I'm going to take the inference that we're here on a fishing expedition. And at some point I'm going to cut this off. Judge Mitchell continues, there's a claims adjuster that can pick up a phone and ask a question. If they are going to cut off benefits, somebody can sure do that. Was that done here? Is there an answer? Mr. Froman's response was, I can put that into a motion, Your Honor. It was never answered.
That's not the agency action we have before us on this review, though, is it?
This is the testimony which establishes the facts.
The ALJ you were referring to is the ALJ who presided over
the first hearing.
The underlying claim, not the bad faith claim.
Right.
And we've got the bad faith penalty claim on this review. what's before us on this review is the bad faith penalty claim.
Correct. I understand. I'm saying, I mean, from the very beginning, we have offered everything from them. When Kelly Brown contacted our office, we wrote him and said, what do you want? What authorizations do you need? And he just said, we want information. We have no information. He's not making any money. And again, at the hearing, Mr. Brown testified that he brought with whatever records he had. The question of Mr. Brown, so you're saying you didn't make a single transaction in those 8 months? You didn't make any money at all? Answer, no, I didn't. How about that transaction in October of 95? Did you make any money? Yes. Since then, have you had any business income? No.
Now, this is after the cutoff?
Pardon?
This is after the cutoff?
Yes, this is at the hearing. They didn't, after they got an attorney, then they requested tax records and they requested business records. Those authorizations were returned immediately. They got those records. We go to the hearing. Those records show that he had a loss.
And you won.
Correct.
That you should not be terminated.
Correct.
That's not before us anymore.
Correct.
You won. No one's appealed, apparently. Now what's before us is your claim of bad faith. You
Correct.
Won. The company lost. Now you say the company failed to give you your benefits, and that was bad faith.
Correct.
I gather that your discussion of the previous transcript is that the Court of Appeals view that it was not fairly debatable that there should be a cutoff. Is that your point?
Absolutely.
And that you're arguing it wasn't fairly debatable because the company knew very little when it terminated. And that it was unfair from the little it knew, namely the suit and the license, that is the business suit, and the license to sell insurance, that from those two factors, which I gather are the key factors that the company knew, you cannot infer that the employee was earning income or earning whatever it needed to earn under the statute.
Correct.
Is that your argument?
The only thing they have is him in a business suit and allegations he's selling insurance.
Okay, and that's enough and not enough to make it fairly debatable that he's cheating.
Absolutely not.
The company says, look, we can't find out whether he's making money or not. We have no access to those kinds of records unless the employee voluntarily gives them to us, right?
Correct.
Okay. Did the company ever ask for income before it terminated?
No.
No. Within a few days after it terminated, it then asked, what are you making?
They didn't even ask that, actually.
Well, let's say you can interpret the letter to so ask.
All right.
All right. Would that change it if you interpret the letter the way I have? Or does bad faith occur on the day it's terminated, or do you look at subsequent events? And I'll put my question this way. Suppose the following week they just reinstated. They found out he didn't have money. He shows them his tax returns. He shows them his books. And then they reinstate. Would it still be bad faith?
Yes.
So it's as of that moment.
It's as of the date they cut it off. The statute says they must have credible evidence when they suspend benefits. And Mr. Frohman was talking about in his earlier about information, that they had information he was selling insurance. The statute doesn't say you can have information, third-hand hearsay or fourth-hand hearsay. It says you must have credible evidence. They had none. I don't know how much time I have left
now,
here.
Suppose they had written your client and said, we need to know whether you had earnings, what your expenses are, et cetera. And your client says, take my word for it, nothing. Can they cut off then? Would that be credible evidence?
No.
How do they get, your client could be lying, right?
Could be.
So how do they get the information?
How about asking for it? How about asking for an authorization? How about asking for tax records? How about asking for an authorization to get insurance records?
And he does all that. The company does all that. And your client says, look, this is all confidential information. I don't have to give it to you. I don't want to give it to you. You have to take my word. I earn nothing.
Okay.
So do you win or lose under that fact situation?
Well, I feel that we still win. They have to have credible evidence. If they have this information that he's selling insurance, they have the right to ask the department to have him sign authorizations to get those things. They have the right to contact neighbors to talk.
So your point is if they can't get the information from your client, they have to go to the LURC, and LURC gets the information for them.
They can do that.
And they have to do that.
That's one option.
Well, what else can they do to get this credible?
Again, we're getting back to Mr. Frohman's argument that this is a fraud case and that everybody's out to commit fraud on the insurance company. And that's just not true. You know, yeah, I suppose if somebody was committing fraud and said, I'm not making any money, and they do get this information from the department, yeah, the person's subject to criminal penalties. He can go to jail for that. You know, but this idea that we don't have to believe anything that they tell us is ridiculous. I have another client who...
Isn't this a bad faith? We're talking about bad faith. That's what the argument is.
Correct.
I want to ask the same question that I asked your opponent, and it deals exactly with what the Chief is talking about here, is that what the knowledge or the reckless activity or reckless disregard that the company lacked a reasonable basis for terminating those benefits. I think isn't that the issue? That's the second prong of the Continental or the Anderson case.
Right. And as I had a cite from the Anderson case which says that it can be implicit from the facts. Mr. Frohman talks in his brief about this guy's an experienced insurance adjuster. He knows what constitutes credible evidence. All he has here are suspicions. At their brief, on page 17, he says, Stone acted as he did not out of recklessness, but based on his many years of claims experience. His experience told him that when someone was working, he was probably earning money. That is a suspicion. That is a hunch. That is not evidence. The statute requires credible evidence. And the statute itself says that when the claim is not fairly debatable and they cut off, and they don't have credible evidence to support that, they are deemed to have acted in bad faith. So, and the Court of Appeals cites the standards throughout. And just like in Anderson, I think it's implicit in the Court of Appeals decision that they did make that finding. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Where in the Court of Appeals opinion do you point to the application of the second prong? They certainly develop it and develop the law with regard to the need to have a second prong quite well in their opinion. But where do they discuss and apply the second prong that they earlier prefaced in their opinion?
Like I say, it's not specifically in there. I think, again, they cite the standards, they cite the second prong, and I think, again, I think it's implicit from the decision.
Let me ask, what part of the Court of Appeals opinion do you point to where I can find it implicit?
The fact that they found it was bad faith as a matter of law, I guess. I can't point to any specific language because they didn't specifically say we're going to address this second prong and we find specifically that they had knowledge that there was no reasonable basis.
Yeah, clearly they didn't do that. But is there some language in the opinion where I can infer and read between the lines, if you can give me the lines, where I can say, okay, they didn't obviously tackle it, you know, they didn't obviously include it in their application of their analysis, but if you look at this paragraph, that's really what they're doing. Is there something
No,
you
I can't
point,
point
to
any, I can't point to any particular portion of the decision itself. I mean, it's 12 pages long. They discuss the law, and I think implicit from the decision is the fact that they're making that finding.
How about paragraph 17? The record demonstrates that Reliance's limited investigation did not provide it with any information that could possibly have led it to conclude that it need not make payment on Brown's claim, and as is evidenced by Tolm's testimony, it knew as much.
Okay.
when it discontinued Brown's benefits.
Thank you. Okay, there it is.
I also, in fact, had that in my mind is the only thing in the opinion that, and I think opposing counsel also referenced this in response to a question, that could be used to address the second prong. I may be incorrect in my reading, but that was my reading of it, the only thing that arguably could be used as an argument that they analyzed and applied the second prong.
All right. Well, I would agree that section covers your question.
This is bothering me, because I want it precise. The holding of the Court of Appeals in part was that we do not have a proper investigation. In fact, they use the proverbial, looking at that same paragraph 17. However, in the absence of a proper investigation, and under the facts of this case, and that's what I meant by proverbial, you know, under the facts of this case, we hold that it was not fairly debatable within the meaning of the law. What is it? What is deficient that makes this an improper investigation in this case? Because, of course, this will be applied in other cases. Otherwise, if we can't apply this in other cases, we shouldn't have taken this case for review. So what rule of law is going to come out of this case as what must an insurance company do to constitute a proper investigation?
Well, they have to have evidence. I mean, they can't just have suppositions and hunches. At the hearing, hearing.
Excuse me. When you say evidence, do the rules of evidence apply in workers' compensation hearings?
Normally. I mean, they're a little bit more lax, I think, than at a trial, but they generally apply.
Is there the rule that I'm just not familiar. Is there a rule that adopts the rules of evidence in workers' compensation?
Yes, they adopt the rules of evidence, but they do apply them a little more liberally than you would in a trial. Now, Mr. Thome was asked that question. What kind of documentation were you expecting that Mr. Brown could provide to you? He says, well, the surveillance report, he was selling insurance for reputable insurance companies. I assumed by contacting the companies that he was selling for, they could provide me with a sales record which shows commissions. He's admitting there that that's the type of thing that he would do. He would contact the insurance companies that he was selling for. He didn't do that before he cut off the benefits. He cut off the benefits and then asked for authorizations after he got an attorney involved. The case of Allied Processors, it's 2001, Wisconsin Appellate 129. It's a bad faith case. It's not a workers' comp case, but the court there said the insurer has the right to exercise its own judgment in determining whether a claim should be settled or contested. But in order to be made in good faith, a decision not to settle a claim must be based on a thorough evaluation of the underlying circumstances of the claim and on the informed interaction with the insured. As Judge Mitchell said, a phone call would have been sufficient. You say, well, what if he denied it? Well, we don't know. I mean, Mr. Brown is not a fraudulent applicant. A phone call to him would have confirmed that, yes, he was trying to sell insurance. The last question I asked Mr. Thome at the hearing, on page 46 of his transcript, I guess one last question. Even as of today, you have no evidence whatsoever. This is in 2001 when the bad faith hearing took place. You have no evidence whatsoever that Mr. Brown made any money during that period of time that he was cut off from his TTD. Correct? Answer, correct. No, he admits. He has no evidence. The statute requires credible evidence, not hunches or suspicions. I don't know. We can't disprove a negative. He asked Brown for income. He says, I don't have any. Go to WMA. Go to my tax returns. Go wherever you want. I didn't make any money. What more can he do?
Well, that's not quite what he said. But I want to return to a legal issue. On rereading Anderson, which is the key case, and on reading Kimberly Clark, which is a Lurk case on bad faith. When I read Kimberly Clark, The Court of Appeals there didn't spend much time on the second prong either. In fact, in a very conclusory paragraph, the last paragraph, it seems to say where the claim isn't fairly debatable, to put it in the other sense. If it's not fairly debatable, then clearly there's reckless disregard. I mean, it's sort of melded the two. And when I looked at Anderson, Anderson says bad faith is an intentional tort. And then it says that a prior case, Hilker, emphasizes that bad faith is the absence of honest, intelligent action or consideration based upon a knowledge of the facts and circumstances under which a decision is predicated. While Hilker emphasizes the duty of ordinary care and reasonable diligence on the part of the insurer, it is apparent from Hilker that the knowing failure, whatever that means, to exercise an honest and informed judgment constitutes the tort of bad faith. So here's my question. Let us assume that it is decided that the issue of termination is not fairly debatable, that it was quite clear it should not have been terminated, or that there isn't enough evidence to show that it should have been terminated. That's your position here. How do you show disregard, the second prong?
Well, again, I think
you, are you bothered by Anderson and Kimberly-Clark, as I was about the second prong?
Well, I don't. I think the statute actually eliminates the second prong. It says if there's not credible evidence that it's fairly debatable, they shall be deemed to have acted in bad faith. Now, whether that just says that's it or there's a rebuttable presumption, I don't know. But the statute basically takes out the knowledge requirement. And the other thing is, I think the cases certainly suggest that any experienced adjuster, the knowledge can be presumed.
Thank you.
May I ask, an administrative law judge issue a summary judgment?
I'm sorry?
Does an administrative law judge have the authority to grant summary judgment?
No.
If we had taken the facts of this case and taken them out of a hearing before an administrative law judge and put them before a circuit judge, could a circuit judge have issued summary judgment on the facts that were presented?
In favor of an applicant? The applicant here? Absolutely. I mean, I think the last bad faith case, I believe, on workers' comp, he said if you have two doctors' opinions, I mean, the injury was conceded. Both doctors conceded that he was in the healing period. They had no evidence to rebut it. I mean, basically what they're arguing is if the adjuster says, I don't believe you, that's good enough. Well, in that case, you might as well rip the statute out of the book because you're never going to have bad faith because the adjuster will always say that. Thank you. I'm sorry. I'm a little over.
Thank you, Mr. Becker. Mr. Frohman.
I must disagree with Mr. Becker's analysis that this is not a fraud case. It is a fraud case, not in the sense that his client, Mr. Kelly Brown, committed fraud. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that this is a fraud case in the sense of how to handle a situation in workers' compensation when there is some evidence in the hands of the carrier that someone is cheating the system, and how do we deal with that? I think the legislature itself recognized the problem. This is an informal system. We do not have summary judgments. We don't have discovery. We rely on quick decisions, and hopefully we do the right thing. And in every case where benefits are suspended, there is hardship, and that's unavoidable sometimes. But this is a fraud case in the sense that the legislature created a statute, 102.125, creating this fraud unit. So we have an individual in the department whose job it is to take phone calls about fraud, about cases that get reported. And this person has no enforcement authority. All they can do is act as a go-between between the carrier, who must investigate it, and then pass it along to the local district attorney, who must, if they have some spare time, prosecute such a fraud case. And it rarely happens. So the commission and the department was concerned about this aspect of the case. What do we do when a carrier receives some information that someone is cheating, and how do they handle it? And I think for those reasons, it is a fraud case. I must disagree with Attorney Becker in the sense when he answered Justice Bradley's questions about the rules of evidence. There are specific cases saying the rules of evidence do not apply to administrative hearings in workers' compensation. While they may be followed to some extent, they are not strictly applicable. And at the point we get to a hearing, it's when the attorneys are involved, it's when subpoenas may be issued. This is long after the fact of that claims manager's decision of what to do in the face of the anonymous tipster, in the face of evidence from his investigator, in the face of information he receives from the workplace, that a man has changed careers. He's off making a fine living, selling insurance. We don't know that for sure. Attorney Becker is correct. We don't have those facts provable in any evidentiary setting, but the claims manager knows this in his head. That's what he's working with. And so he acts from what he knows and what the system permits him to know at that point in time.
Well, can the employer get help from the commission to get information?
That whole notion seems preposterous to me. That I'd never in 25 years of experience in this system, have heard of a case where someone has appealed to the commission for help in investigating a claim. It never happens. The commission would say to you, you know, when this issue is before us, we will rule on it. And if you go to the department and say, well, we need some enforcement, they'll say, well, someone has to file an application before we will deal with any dispute. There's no dispute if benefits are being paid voluntarily.
Would you identify the items of credible evidence that the insurance company had in its possession which justified the suspension of benefits?
There were essentially three sources. There was the call from the fraud hotline person at the Workers' Compensation Division, and that person told the claims manager that an anonymous person says that Kelly Brown is outworking, was the phrase, and receiving temporary total disability benefits and is bragging about it.
That's an anonymous tip, though. There's no way to evaluate its credibility.
That is not enough. If the carrier at that point said, let's flip the switch, we're cutting him off, I would have to agree that would be bad faith. That's not enough.
Well, can we count it at all? That's just something that prompts an investigation.
I think it has to count for some, a grain of suspicion in the carrier's mind. What's going on here? I need to look at this situation. And then everything that follows falls into place, that this anonymous tipster must be onto something. Everything that claims manager finds out from that point forward.
But what is that everything that you're referring to?
The next thing is the grocery store manager. He asks around, what's the word here about Mr. Brown and what is he up to?
Okay, that's third hand as to the insurance company.
It's Mr. Becker raised this point at the benefit hearing that this is hearsay. My response, it's not hearsay when you're talking about the mind of the claims manager. What he thought, what he knew, is what we're trying to get at. Did he have a good intent or a bad intent? I mean, his intent was formed on what he was told. All claims people find out stuff from hearsay information. It's all telephone. It's all second, third hand. It's not unusual. It's correct that in a court of law, it wouldn't be good enough. But in the mind of a claims manager, there's a red flag. And Justice Rogensack mentioned the business about temporary total disability. That is another definite red flag when you hear, as a claims manager, that someone you're paying TTD benefits to is out working. Now, that may not necessarily mean you can cut that person off, but it's a big red flag, and you do need to investigate it, because the leading case in temporary total disability is the Nobby case, and that case defines it as saying the person is unable to work.
Chief, just one quick question, if I may. Is the focus of credible evidence on the reasonableness of the insurance company? In other words, is there credible evidence to support that the respondent had a reasonable basis for believing the applicant was engaged in urged wage-earning activity? Or is the credible evidence focused on whether or not he was indeed. Do you understand my nuance here? Is the question whether or not he was indeed engaged in it?
Yes.
What we're trying to search the record to find evidence to support, or is the focus on whether or not there is credible evidence to support a reasonable belief, a reasonable basis for believing? What's your answer?
I understand, Justice.
Are you asking whether an objective standard of any reasonable person who gets all of these indicia and flags would find it debatable, or that this particular person subjectively found it debatable? Is that not quite?
Not quite.
Okay.
The way I understand your question is that when the phrase credible evidence comes up in these bad faith cases, I don't view that as evidence that would be sufficient in a court of law. I view that as meaning credible information, credible knowledge in the mind of the carrier. What did it know? When did it know it? Some of this evidence, as counsel points out, would not be admissible, and I freely agree with that. But we're dealing with a system of paying benefits without all the information, and suspending benefits sometimes without all the information.
Not necessarily this carrier, any objective carrier.
Any carrier is operating under similar circumstances here.
Right. Okay.
Thank you, Justice.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank both Mr. Frohman and Mr. Becker on behalf of the court for presenting excellent arguments this morning. We are in recess until 1:45. The students should remain here, and Justice Robin Sack will be out to speak with them. Anyone else who wishes to attend may do so.